Welcome to episode 198 of the GTO on 5G. It's the latest Insight Scoop on everything 5G. We cover six topics in about 20 minutes, and it's brought to you by More Insights and Strategy. I'm Will Townsend, and joining me again this week is fellow analyst Anshul Sag. We want to apologize to our viewers and listeners. I was caught up on vacation and had roof construction at my home in the Florida Keys. So that's why we're delaying things, but I did have a great 4th. I spent 2 weeks down there. And Anshul, what did you do for the 4th?
I stayed home.
Did you go to a baseball game?
No.
Okay. Sometimes staying at home and being a new dad is a good thing.
Yep.
Cool. Let me jump into my first topic, and I want to talk about Hurricane Beryl and the disaster communication efforts by T-Mobile and Verizon to bring connectivity to South Texas. This was a devastating hurricane. I'm always on the lookout because, as I mentioned, I have a home in the Florida Keys. But this was the earliest hurricane on record, and it was a monster. It was a Cat 5, and as it hit the Gulf, it picked up steam, and it hit Houston. And many parts of Houston, I'm told, are still out of power. There's a lot of pandemonium that's going on with that. People that are very frustrated not having electricity for obvious reasons, first and foremost, air conditioning, lack of air conditioning. But connectivity becomes a really important factor in not only search and rescue, but also in just giving people that needed connectivity to be able to reach loved ones and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, there were 14 deaths. But I do applaud AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon for stepping up and providing connectivity. And just a great example of how mobile network operators can mobilize and leverage technology to get connectivity, at least temporary connectivity, back into these areas. And so with they used actually flying a cell on wheels, so they used drone technology to be able to get basically radio towers up in the air to establish temporary connectivity. I don't believe this was for first responders. It was more for their subscribership. And that was very effective in breaching or addressing the breach in communications there. I read that T-Mobile actually, and I'm not sure if you caught this, my friend, but T-Mobile used satellite cells on trucks, so Colts, and also satellite-based cows. And I'm assuming there may have been some SpaceX involvement with that effort. But two great examples of using the latest technology like drones and satellite to provide connectivity when it's needed. Verizon, I dug into Verizon. I'm sure they did some of the same things, but what they really talked about was ensuring that all of their backup systems and their kind of corporate locations and their switch locations and that sort of thing were up and running. And that's something that Verizon's been very focused on historically. They've always bragged about having the nation's most reliable network. And I've spent time with them as well and have spent time with their professionals in Bedminster, on the East Coast. They have an operations center there, a network operations center. So all three mobile network operators really stepping up to the task. Again, it's just a great example of how these companies are leveraging things like low Earth orbit and drone technology to support connectivity. And I'm sure you were following the news because it was big news. And as the hurricane moved from Texas, it moved up the East Coast. And certainly you're in California, so you weren't affected by that. But do you have any insights into the response from these three operators?
Yeah, they did their job. I think that's really the core of it. I was almost affected by it because I was in New York City. New York didn't actually get the remnants of the storm like it was supposed to. I was expecting to have rain all week in New York when I was there, and it actually didn't rain at all. That was probably a good thing because New York City is very big. Again, the last few times I've been there, I've gotten hurricane remnant and a lot of the cities. I think we as a nation are not properly prepared for a lot of these natural storms, but I will say that the carriers have gotten their act together and they are mostly prepared for these things, but they are going to continue to get worse, more frequent, and that is just a reality.
Yeah, for sure. And my thoughts and prayers are going out to the residents of Houston, Matagorda County, south of Houston. I lived there for 10 years. Both my daughters were born there, and we went through a lot of tropical storms and a lot of power outages, and there are still widespread power outages all over the city of Houston, and people are getting a little restless, and they're doing what I'm hearing, some pretty idiotic things with these line workers. Just for our viewers and listeners, get the word out. CenterPoint Energy is working super hard in South Texas to get things restored. So let's all be a little more patient there. But hey, that reference to New York is a great setup for your first topic this week. And you were at Galaxy Unpacked, right? The Samsung event.
Yeah, I was actually at a satellite event in New York. The actual event was in Paris. So a lot of people were in Paris for that. I was not. I was in New York for that event, but I was there also for two other events the same week. I think just some of our colleagues were also at an AWS event in New York as well. So if there was a potential, I could have actually been there for four events, but that would have been insane. But yeah, basically Galaxy Unpacked, that Samsung's big smartphone reveal. They do two of those a year usually. They do one early in the year for the S series. And then they do another one later for the Z series, which are their foldables. It used to be that they did it for the Note series, but now the Note has been integrated into the S series. So it is now just for foldables. Generally, it's not this early in the year. It's usually in August or in September, but now it's moved up to July. Mm-hmm. That said, the S series used to be a February, March thing, and now it's a January thing. So Samsung's moving up their time frames. And basically, this new Galaxy Z series also came with a new wearable. We got the new Z Fold 6, the Z Fold or Z Flip 6. The Fold is the one that opens like a book, and the Flip is the one that closes in half. And then on top of those two, we also got a new Samsung Galaxy Watch Ultra and a Galaxy Watch 7. Those two are based on the same new 3-nanometer processor from Samsung. The Z Flip series and Z Fold series use the same Snapdragon 8 Gen 3 globally, so there are no Samsung chips in those. And then they also announced the Galaxy Ring. They announced three new wearables. Oh, they also announced Buds 3 and Buds 3 Pro. They announced four new wearables and two new phones. It was a very jam-packed announcement. I think most people were really anticipating the Folds and the Flips and the Ring. And I actually wear an Aura Ring, so I'm excited to use the new Ring. Some reviewers already have them, but they should be available in the next few days. All of the phones and all of the wearables are available on the 24th. So pre-orders are still open, and there's still some pre-order deals available. But yeah, I think the Ring is actually quite good. It's really thin and light, much thinner and lighter than the Aura Ring, and it doesn't require a super battery, but it only works on Android phone. I think the Galaxy Watch Ultra is interesting, but it's like a wannabe Apple Watch Ultra. It's got a bigger battery, bigger screen, but that's about it. And even better water immersion capabilities. But in terms of the phones, they're all 5G. I really like the Flip because it's more upgraded, better sensor, bigger battery. It just seems like they tried harder, bigger screen. So if there's a phone to go for out of these announcements, the Flip is it. Fold is very incremental improvement. In fact, the Fold 6 has almost the same camera as the Fold. So they've really dropped the ball on the camera capabilities, which is weird because a lot of the other foldables out there have great cameras now.
Yeah.
I think Samsung could do better. I think they need more competition. And we might see something from Google in the next few weeks. They're going to be having a Made by Google event in August on Key. That's less than a month away. And I will be there. So I will give you guys my thoughts on that when that happens.
So it sounds like you're going to get a demo of the Ring. Are you going to be doing a forum write-up or a research note from the firm on these phones? Oh, wow. Okay, I'm impressed.
Waiting for our editor to give me my feedback.
Cool, yeah. So for our viewers and listeners, stay on the lookout for Anshul's article that's coming up there. Hey, let me go to my second topic, and I want to talk about Germany and the rip and replace of Chinese infrastructure. This is something that I have talked about on numerous podcasts, but there were a couple of articles that I caught. One was on Mobile World Live, and another one may have been on the Fierce Network. But it makes you wonder if Germany is dragging its feet with their effort to rip and replace. It's no surprise that a good majority of Iran infrastructure in Germany is Huawei. It's like by several accounts, it's up to 50% of Iran infrastructure is Huawei. And initially, Germany committed to replacing all of that hardware by the end of 2026, I believe. But now, some new news is coming out around a wrinkle into that plan. And what the German government is saying is that by 2029, they're more concerned about the management layer software, the automation and the orchestration and that sort of thing, and that they are setting a timeline for phasing that out by the end of 2029. That's 3 years after any sort of infrastructure removal. But it just seems, if you read between the lines here, that Germany is somewhat dragging its feet. Now, if it's true that, and I can't verify this, and there's probably a way for you and I to verify it, but if half of their RAN infrastructure is either Huawei or ZTE, that's a heavy lift, man, to replace all that equipment. Even if you're going disaggregated and you're using things like vRAN and OpenRAN. What do you think? Did you catch any of these news articles? Do you have any thoughts about Germany dragging their feet? Usually you and I do this point counterpoint, and sometimes we agree and sometimes we don't. But what do you think?
I think that Germany gobbled up Huawei too quickly. They saw a route to quick and cheap deployment. And this is the consequence of that. I believe that 2% is quite an undertaking, but I think it's also on them to acknowledge their mistake. I think what it is fundamentally, I don't think the carriers believe that the government is justified in their edict. So they're not really feeling like they need to do this or want to do it. So because of, I think you're seeing them drag their feet. I think you then use that term. I just think that there needs to be a little bit more fire under their butts. And I don't think they ever wanted this, unless the government mandates it in a way that makes them move faster. It's an expensive lift. And I'm sure that the Nokias and the Ericssons and the Samsungs of the world would love to see them have to make changes quickly, especially considering our future topics for this week.
Yeah, for sure. And what's interesting, Germany is a very technology forward country relative to others in Europe. What's also interesting is that the European Union is much different than the US, and that each individual country, and we've talked about this numerous times on our podcast, they make the decisions around regulation and spectrum auctions and that sort of thing. So it's likely the European Commission and it's a parallel to the FCC in the United States. It's likely the European Commission that is putting this pressure on Germany, and to your point, This is something that likely Germany in particular is pushing back on. But it'll be really interesting to see how this all plays out. Certainly, when you think about infrastructure deployment for the sake of infrastructure, without the management layer, it's just a bunch of stuff. It's just a bunch of servers and antennas and that sort of thing. But what the concern really, and from my perspective, I've talked about this before when I've spoken with journalists, the concern really is around the software management layer, the orchestration, the BIOS, the OS. And if you're using something that is Chinese, then there's potentially backdoors that are built in it that are designed for spying and control and that sort of thing, and zombie zombification of operations. It's interesting that they're pushing back and stating that, okay, we're focused on the management layer, the hardware is a hardware, but that the timeline is 3 years after the sort of the hardware rip and replace. I don't know. This is newly developing, and it's going to be really interesting to continue to monitor this. And I'm sure we'll be talking about this on future podcasts. But let's move to your second topic. And you want to talk about Boost Mobile and a reset for that prepaid service.
Yes. So the carrier known as Boost is now a part of Dish. That carrier was once part of Sprint and called, if you remember, Boost Mobile Zone, Where You At? That was like their whole shtick. So they've done some rebranding. They've changed the logo. And they've also introduced new plans and pricing. So now you can get in 2 Boosts. And I believe the price is $25 is the entry price. Here, I have the breakdown of all the prices. Basically $25 added if you sign up initially with autopay, 30 gigs of a month for 30 gigs for $25 a month for life.
Yeah.
They're saying you get unlocked, you get locked in. And then the $50 plan gives you hotspot and 40 gigs with global talk and text. And then there's a a $60 tier with a bunch of 50 gigs and all those other features as well. And then another one called Infinite Access, which is a $65 plan, which includes an annual device upgrade. So this is definitely a more affordable plan. The boost sits way below where our AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile are today. So it'll be interesting to see how this matches up. Because they're claiming 99% coverage thanks to their own network, but also share agreement. But I have already requested a SIM to try it out myself, but I do not have one yet, so I cannot give you an assessment. But I'm really excited and interested to see how this works out, because I think price competition is always important. And let's be real, Dish needs subscribers. So if this network works, coverage is there, that's ultimately what people care about.
Yeah, but at that subscription price, like, how competitive is that with Mint Mobile? T-Mobile acquired Mint Mobile. I'm seeing lots of ads for $15 a month. I'm assuming that the data for auto, the data limit is lower. Do you any insight there?
Yeah, so there's no specifics on throughput, but what they do say is that you get a certain amount of data. And the thing is that when you look at something like Mint Mobile, they have an interesting structure, because it depends on what your size of bucket is, because Mint Mobile actually goes down to 5 gigs. So you can get 5 gigs of data for $15 a month. And there's an upfront prepaid fee associated with that. You can get an unlimited plan with them as well, but I have a feeling that even their unlimited plans are actually probably capped at a certain gigabyte capacity, because their biggest plan is 20 gigs, and that's 15 to 35, depending on the length of a deal. So none of these are actually really on a month-to-month basis anymore. They're all month plans, the minimums. Not really sure how these compare, because I don't really think they do. But I think closely, there's some similarities. And I think that, from what I can tell, it really seems like Boost wants to keep things simple for people. And I do think that that's a reasonably good price for entry, because it's not $15, but or $20 for that matter. You're starting at 30 gigs of data. So you're already starting in a higher bucket than what Mint is offering. So I think it's pretty competitive, because the cheapest plan from Mint, the $25 plan, which is comparable to what Boost is offering, is 20 gigs. So you're actually getting less data on Mint. So I think it's competitive, and I think it'll be interesting to see how they shape up. There are limits, like you said, on Mint, and we'll see if there are limits on Boost.
Yeah. Interesting. You had all the facts, so I appreciate you clarifying that for both me and our viewers and listeners. Hey, I'm going to hit my third topic pretty quickly. I want to talk about Ericsson, and there was a recent earnings call with their CEO, and he admitted that they've not executed in the short term with their Vonage acquisition and their API strategy. And so it makes me wonder, is there still long-term potential? So on this earnings call, and this is actually an article that Dan Meyer, who I know well at SCX Info, wrote up. But earlier this month, Ericsson wrote off another, what was the amount, $1.1 billion impairment charge to its acquisition of Vonage. So if you add that to the initial write-off, it's getting pretty close to writing off the entire $6.2 billion investment that the company made in Vonage. But apparently in this article on SCX Central, and we can provide the link when we post the podcast, the CEO, his name's Jorge Elcom, he spoke about that they're still very bullish on API, and given the programmability and the ability to bring developers in very early to innovate on top of the investment that MNOs make and these next generation 5G networks. And so his words were like, but hold your breath before you assess the overall transaction. But apparently Ericsson's still bullish that long term, that this could be a positive thing for the company. It just sounds like it's taking longer for the whole API thing to catch on. And I think certainly if he sees the value in it, obviously in partnering with Ericsson and moving a lot of the AT&T network to disaggregated infrastructure, but also taking advantage of the programmability that comes along with that, So I just think maybe Ericsson was just a little ahead of itself and maybe didn't set the right expectation for how quickly Vonage could be accretive and really drive this whole API ecosystem. I will add that Nicholas, and I'm forgetting his last name, you could remind me if you know it, that he was formerly the Ericsson president of North America. He's now running the Vonage business. Patrick Moorhead, our founder, has spent a lot of time with him, and Patrick seems to be very bullish on what Nicholas has shared with him, but it just seems like this is taking a little bit longer for Ericsson to realize the value. So I know you've got an opinion on this, so I'll let you fire away.
Yeah, here's the thing. This reminds me a lot of Microsoft's acquisition of Nokia, which was a full write-down. This basically, in my book, is a full write-down. So when you fully write something down, you effectively acknowledge it's not valuable. It has lost its value. I hate to say it, but regardless of how successful this ends up being, it's a loss. It's a total loss. So I think you're being a bit.
Okay.
I think you're being a bit optimistic. If this generates some kind of revenue in the future, it will have been so marginally insignificant to the total spend of how much Vonage cost. What was the total cost of Vonage at this point that they paid?
$6.1 or $7.2 billion. So they're going to have to monetize the hell out of it over the next 5 years. To your point, yeah.
No, even if they captured almost every customer in the world that could potentially be a customer, they maybe would recover $6 billion. So I just think it was a bad acquisition. I think somebody at Vonage did a great job of selling the company to them. But yeah, I think it was a mistake. And this is basically an acknowledgement that there is nothing left to realize.
Wow. There you have it, our viewers and listeners, point, counterpoint. That's why I love doing these with Anshul, or we've been doing them for, man, we're going to start our fifth year or next year coming up here. But hey, so let's keep the theme of Nordic cellular infrastructure providers going. And you want to close this week's podcast with Nokia's earnings. And I did catch this. I'm going to let you take it, and then I'm going to provide some color as well.
This was a pretty big one. This happened yesterday. Nokia basically reported a huge decline in profit. It declined down to 423 million euros, down nearly a third from 600 million euros in the same period a year ago. And they said that most of the impact was the challenging year-ago comparison period, which saw the peak of India's rapid 5G deployment in India, accounting for 3/4 of the decline. So basically, India kept them afloat last year, and this year India has petered out, so they aren't really realizing as much profit. And I think that's just like that's a cool thing, but I also have to say that Nokia hasn't really been having great quarters for a while now. If anything, the quarter a year ago was saved by India, and now there's no India to save it. Also, they did lay off 14,000 people last year, and they're probably still laying those people off, because you can't just lay off 14,000 people in the blink of an eye. So there's, and that was due to a huge plunge in third quarter earnings. I feel like we keep talking about Nokia being in a place where things aren't great. Feels like there are some bright spots, like in private networking, but they aren't really realizing themselves fast enough or big enough to save Nokia's earnings. That said, they are still a profitable company, but their stock was down 8%. I'm actually a believer that like they're in a tough spot in terms of the market. And I think that they will, if they keep on with their strategy, I think they will be successful. Their net sales were down 18%. It's a tough place. And it said that this was their lowest level of revenue since the fourth quarter of 2015. So, this is definitely, I think, them kind of reaching the end of 5G's growth in terms of revenue. And maybe private networking just hasn't picked up early enough for them to potentially find that growth opportunity for profit. But that's my thought. I think private networking is going to save them eventually. It's just not happening.
Yeah, and I've talked about this on prior podcasts. The adoption curve has not been the hockey stick that a lot of people would have thought with private 5G networking. We're beginning to see more pockets. I will point out that I recorded the Game Time Tech podcast with Mel Brew and Robert Kramer, two analysts in our firm, and we talked about the Paris Olympics, how Cisco is partnering with Orange, but to deploy a standalone 5G network with 60 IP sites to facilitate production and streaming of content around the world. And also, obviously, that private standalone network is going to support fan activations and concessions and the mobility that's needed so that you don't have to run tons of cables along the Seine River and that sort of thing. I do believe that Kia's got two, I think, bright spots from my perspective. One around optical, they're right up there with Cisco and even Huawei. Huawei's pretty big in optical transport networks and the private networking thing. So I think as we see further adoption, I think that could be a bright spot for them. I also believe that security could be a bright spot for Nokia as well, just given their investment with labs and their labs efforts in those sort of things. And that's actually something that I'm beginning to spend more time with the Nokia team to understand their security strategy. And I hope to be able to share more in the coming months around them. But yeah, it just seems like with Nokia, it's been this ebb and flow. I just remember two Mobile World Congresses ago, they relaunched their strategy and they had a new brand mark and they had a reinvigorated focus on enterprise services. And it just seemed they were moving down the right track. And then we see the slowdown in RAN spend, right? Because all the RAN in non-standalone got built out. And then people started turning to, or mobile network operators started turning to core network infrastructure. And they got caught in that because they've been a big leader, in the RAN space. So I think there's a perfect storm going on around them. I'm optimistic that because I'm the glasses half full guy, I'm optimistic that they've got the right assets to turn things around. But to your point, the reduction in force is a little bit troubling when times are tough. And it's like this hire and fire mentality that I experienced a little bit of that when I was in corporate America. And that's been 10 plus years since I've been in corporate America. But that's not productive. In fact, a very good friend of mine who had left Cisco to join Nokia as president of North America, he was caught up in that as well. And he's landed and he's doing quite well. But you got to move beyond this hire and fire mentality and invest in the long haul and see it through and really focus on what you're good at. Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how things roll. But with that, it's been another great podcast. Again, our apologies to our viewers and listeners for skipping a week, but it's been crazy for Anshul and I with personal and professional travel. But my friend, I'm going to let you take us home.
Absolutely. We hope our viewers and listeners found these topics interesting. If anyone out there would like to provide insights on a future project, future topic for a future podcast, please reach out to us on social media. Will's at Will's on Tech, and I'm at Anshul's blog. We hope you have a great weekend, and please tune in again next week. And don't forget to rate us and subscribe.